Thank you, Professor, for your welcome, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you to the Curtin Institute and to Fincia for putting on such a splendid function and giving me the opportunity to visit Perth again, which is always a pleasure. My topic today is the conduct of monetary policy in crisis and recovery. With economic conditions improving, people's questions very quickly go to what next for monetary policy. Financial markets were the first to ask that question, actually, as soon as the policy rate stopped falling earlier in the year. The pundits there very quickly began to speculate about the timing of the first increase. Initially, that seemed, at least to me, a little bit premature. But now it's a year since the dramatic events of September and October of 2008 dictated a sharp change of course for monetary policy, not only here in Australia, but around the world. So the question as to how things will be conducted in the next phase is probably a reasonable one now. And it's understandable if it's a prominent one at the moment following the Board's decision last week to raise the cash rate by 0.25%. The bank's already conveyed a good deal of its thinking about these questions, actually, through our regular statements after each meeting, the ensuing disclosure of the minutes, the detailed public material we put out, and other things that I've said on previous occasions. But today, perhaps, it's an appropriate juncture to try to round some of these things up. So I want to elaborate a little about some of the issues which have been germane to the conduct of monetary policy in the past year, and to talk a little about some of the things which look like they will be relevant in the period ahead. Before I do that, though, I think it is worth recounting the framework for monetary policy that we have and that we've had for some 16 or 17 years now, the process that we go through in reaching the decision, and then the process by which that decision actually gets implemented and affects the economy. I think that's worth doing because at the start of a new phase of expansion in the economy, which is where I think we are, it's a good thing to remind people just what the framework is. As you may know, the centrepiece for our monetary policy framework is a target, a numerical target for CPI inflation. That framework and that target, the way it's configured, embodies two quite important ideas that we have learned as economists over a very long period of both theory and practice about monetary matters. The first important idea is that in the long run, monetary policy is about the value of money, that is, it's about prices. Over long horizons, the size of the economy, its rate of growth, will be driven by developments on the supply side of the economy, by the amount of labour and land that's available, by the amount of accumulation of real capital that we have, technology, and the efficiency with which we are able to use all those things, that is productivity. Monetary policy can't make those things grow faster over the long run, even over the short run. So that's the first important idea. In the long run, it's about prices. The second idea is that in the short run, monetary policy does affect the real economy because it has an impact on aggregate demand. If, for example, trend inflation has risen in the economy, it's usually necessary to have a period of weaker growth in demand in order to get inflation to slow down. But we don't want that period to be any longer or more pronounced than necessary. By the same token, if as a result of some shock to the economy, spending has fallen such that demand is below the economy's potential supply capacity, inflation will probably fall, and that will give monetary policy scope to be a bit easier for a while, and that in turn will help to underpin spending and economic activity. So there are both these long-term and short-term dimensions. And the framework we have where we aim to keep CPI inflation at between 2 and 3% on average over time balances those two ideas quite effectively. The on average specification means that deviations from the inflation target in the short term, which are often unavoidable anyway, can be tolerated, but there is a commitment to reverse them over time. This allows the economy's growth potential, which is determined by all those supply-side factors, productivity and so on, to be realised over time. At the same time, though, having an explicit numerical goal for inflation helps to anchor expectations of inflation, which is very important, and it works over time to preserve the value of money. As such, that framework is, in our view, fully consistent with and indeed gives practical expression to the objectives that the bank has as set down in the legislation. They are the stability of the currency, they're the words that are used, and that really means the currency's purchasing power, full employment, and the economic prosperity and welfare of the people of Australia. The framework has bipartisan support in the Parliament, and it has had for quite a long time now. It's also been in practice over the decade and a half or more that we've been using it, the most effective framework for policy that Australia so far has had. The target is expressed in terms of the Consumer Price Index. Now, the CPI is only one of many price indexes which are compiled and which one might choose in principle. But the CPI was chosen because it's the best known and most accepted published price index. It's pretty reliable, and it presents fewer problems of an analytical nature for this purpose than other indexes we might choose. So that's the framework, a medium-term, flexible inflation target that preserves the value of money over time, but gives monetary policy some short-term flexibility to cope with shocks which hit the economy. Let me turn then to the process of reaching the decision. The bank is continually examining a vast amount of statistical and survey information. There are literally somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 individual data sets for the Australian economy and other economies around the world that the staff in the economic area monitor. An array of financial information from our own financial markets and those around the world is monitored on a daily basis. That work is complemented by an extensive program of business liaison. There's probably quite a few of you here, actually, whose companies talk to our staff that go around visiting firms and organisations each month, about 100 organisations around the country every month. And I want to say to those of you who do give us your time and insights how much that is appreciated. It's genuinely very helpful. It's not just tokenism, it's really used, and I thank you for giving us your time, and please keep doing that. So we have business liaison. Our financial markets area also has very close contact with the financial institutions and other market players in our own financial markets here in Australia. The Reserve Bank itself, because it has a $100 billion balance sheet to manage, is an active participant in financial markets in its own right, both in Australia and in major markets offshore. And so we get quite a lot of intelligence from being a market participant. In the lead up to the board meeting, all of that information is very carefully evaluated. Prior to the board's meeting and the week before, there's a get together of the most senior staff of the bank at which we discuss what we should recommend to the board at its forthcoming meeting. Papers are prepared that round up all the factual information, the liaison information. They give the staff's judgment on issues of interpretation in the data, and there's usually some of those to cope with. Topics of special interest, all these things are prepared. There's a 4 to 5 page overview paper which rounds up the key issues and puts the recommendation. All that material goes out on the Thursday evening or Friday morning ahead of the meeting, and the members get the papers on the Friday ahead of the Tuesday meeting. At the meeting, the most senior staff of the bank present to the board the most important issues arising from the papers. There's extensive discussion and a lot of questioning about this material. I can assure you that, contrary to what is sometimes said, the board is no rubber stamp, and its members, I can tell you, are no group of shrinking violets. These are very substantial people. They come from a diverse set of backgrounds. They bring their own experiences and their own independently gleaned information about what is going on in the economy. So the analysis and the arguments that the staff and the management of the bank put up are well and truly tested. If there's any weaknesses there, they will very quickly become apparent. And that's as it should be, of course. Well, that discussion takes about 3 hours, and I would think it is probably the most intense regular discussion of economic conditions that occurs in the country, as of course it should be. At the end of that discussion, the Governor, as Chairman of the Board, will sum up and introduce the policy question. Each member has the opportunity to give their view on the question at hand and the reasoning behind their view. And typically it's fairly clear what the consensus is, and then the decision is taken. It remains at that point to issue a statement. Now, the board meeting is not a drafting session. The members are typically content to leave it to the governor to issue the statement on their behalf, on the understanding that the statement is consistent with the tone of the discussion at the meeting. So that's it then follows to issue that statement at 2:30 in the afternoon on the day of the meeting, even on Melbourne Cup Day. And so the community is quite quickly informed what the decision is and why we took it. Subsequently, the draft minutes of the meeting are prepared. They're actually, from our last meeting at present, being commented on by the members, and they'll be published with any necessary amendments next Tuesday. So that's 2 weeks after the meeting, and a day or two after that, the whole thing starts over again. In addition to all that, if that isn't enough, every 3 months the bank publishes a very detailed statement on the state of the economy and financial markets and issues for policy, which typically runs to about 70 pages. If you're having trouble sleeping in the evening, I recommend that will certainly help. So all of that's already known. The point of recounting it is simply to remind people and reassure people that there is a very extensive, nationwide, detailed, careful process undertaken here each month, both in making the decision and in taking care to explain why the decision was made. Let me talk then a little bit about the transmission process. A lot of effort goes into that decision, but that decision determines one interest rate in the economy, and it's actually quite a specialised interest rate at that. There are other channels through which monetary policy works, the exchange rate, expectations, and other areas, and they are important, but for today I'm going to leave them aside and make a couple of remarks about the interest rate channel. Now, the cash rate, the overnight rate that we set, is literally the rate to borrow cash overnight in the interbank market. So these are funds that banks keep on deposit at the RBA, and they borrow and lend as needed between each other on an overnight basis. So it's a 24-hour interest rate. It's a very active market, the cash market, but only quite a small proportion of total borrowing in the Australian economy is actually done in that market. To have its broader effect then, monetary policy relies on changes in the overnight rate affecting the spectrum of other interest rates in the economy. And indeed they do. The cash rate today and how it's expected to evolve over the next 6 months or a year does form the anchor for the yield curve. So that's quite important, and it gives monetary policy considerable power. But other factors are also at work in determining those other interest rates. Term premia, so that is the idea that the longer money is tied up for, the more you have to pay to get it. And compensation for risk also are factors that can have an impact on the cost of borrowing for financial institutions and therefore the rates that they charge their borrowers. Now, for some years, those other factors were relatively stable. Compensation for risk actually tended to decline very gradually for quite some years as the search for yield by investors drove down market interest rates, and as competition between intermediaries to lend everywhere in the world, including here, increased. So in net terms, loan rates actually fell gradually over time relative to the cash rate. But on the whole, these other factors were fairly stable 1 month to the next, and so changes in the cash rate came to be seen as driving all the important interest rate changes in the economy. But that was actually, historically speaking, a little bit unusual. In the past 18 months or so, in contrast, a sharp reappraisal by investors about how much they should be compensated for risk has seen some of these other factors that affect interest rates start to move. As a result, the various interest rates that intermediaries have to pay to raise funds have sometimes moved rather independently of changes in the Reserve Bank cash rate. The bank has actually published a detailed treatment of intermediaries' funding costs, which I think gives quite a useful framework in which to think about these issues, and so I won't go into them today. But I'll just make a couple of observations about the shifting costing margins that intermediaries have faced and therefore passed on to their customers. First, during the phase when interest rates were falling, when the cash rate was falling, interest rates for most borrowers still came down a lot because the cash rate falls were so big. In fact, for mortgages, for floating rate mortgages, they reached over the past year their lowest level since 1964. At the margin, the cash rate cuts that the Reserve Bank Board implemented were bigger than they would otherwise have been because the board could see that these margins that the intermediaries were having to pay and pass on were widening. Likewise, in future decisions, the board will take careful note of any changes to spreads that might occur. Secondly, in Australia, housing loan rates in particular came down much more than has been the case in a number of other countries. That's partly because we have more floating rate loans here, in contrast, say, to the United States, but also because even on floating rate loans, the spread between the mortgage rate and the central bank rate didn't widen here to anything like the extent that it has in some other countries. That is a sort of long-winded way of saying that monetary policy still worked quite effectively in Australia in this period, despite the fact that some of these risk margins were moving around a bit. Let me talk then about the conduct of policy during the crisis. Going into the crisis, if you think back in 2007, the global economy was actually growing very strongly. It recorded growth in global GDP of 5% that year, which is well above average, and it capped off several years of above average growth. The US economy had been slowing for a while as these financial burdens began to gradually increase, but even in the first quarter of 2008, global GDP was still growing at 4%, which is a very healthy pace. Prices for most commodities were still rising. In fact, oil prices would not reach their peak until July of 2008. Our economy was operating at full stretch, and I don't need to tell people in Western Australia that. Our terms of trade were showing their biggest gain for 50 years. Delivering a very large income gain to the community. Confidence was high. Firms routinely complained of labour shortages. Inflation was rising, in fact, worryingly so, towards the end of 2007. And demand for credit was strong. So in that world, the Reserve Bank was running quite tight monetary policy in order to contain inflation. Well, we needed to do that. We now know, although we couldn't know for sure at the time, that inflation was on its way to 5%. As measured by the CPI. Underlying inflation, which seeks to look through temporary impacts, got to about 4.5%. Those outcomes were well above our target, and it couldn't credibly be claimed that they were just due to temporary factors or imported factors. In fact, here in late 2009, we're still to see whether inflation will come back down and be consistent with the target over time. Now, we think it will be, but that, as of today, still is a forecast. So that was the world we faced going into the crisis. The big rise in energy prices in 2008 crimped growth in the emerging world and the major countries alike, and all of those showed a significant softening in the middle of that year. It was starting to emerge by then in Australia that demand, which had been very strong, was starting to at least slow down. Though even then, domestic final spending in Australia rose 5% over the year to the middle of 2008, which is well above average and still quite a strong figure. Nonetheless, it was moderating. And at that point, the board was in a position to start thinking about when we could start to ease monetary policy in anticipation of inflation turning down. It was still heading towards its peak at that point, but we were seeking to look ahead to the peak and the subsequent decline in the setting of policy. And the easing phase of policy actually began in September of 2008. Then, about 2 weeks after that, the simmering tensions in the Northern Hemisphere financial system erupted with the Lehman event, and we had the most dramatic 6 weeks or so that any of us have lived through. The ensuing sequence of crashing share markets, enormous financial strains, the need to rescue struggling banks or otherwise support them with guarantees around the world, and so on, had a massive effect on confidence of households and businesses everywhere. As a result of that, demand for goods, in particular, slumped all around the world. Most economies went into recession. In a number of cases, that has been a severe recession. So that turn of events required a significant change in monetary policy thinking in Australia. Instead of the gradual easing of policy that we had been anticipating as inflation gently subsided, the board concluded last October that we needed to be considerably more aggressive in lowering interest rates. Australian households and businesses understandably began to react to these events abroad. That meant that there was likely to be a much weaker outcome for demand and therefore inflation than we had expected up to that time. That change to the outlook was reflected in changes to the central forecasts that the bank staff prepared. And the board responded to that, but the board responded to more than just that change in the sort of consensus view. It also responded to the risk that in this environment of acute global financial strain and deleveraging, there could easily be an even weaker outcome than the ones in the lower forecasts. Accordingly, the cash rate was reduced very quickly at the end of last year and a little bit further in the early part of this year. So we were adopting a risk management approach, if you like, where policy responded quickly and quite strongly to a situation where there was a higher than normal risk of a very bad outcome. That, I think, is fully consistent with the inflation targeting framework that I outlined earlier. A more conventional approach would have seen the board wait a bit longer for evidence of weaker activity and lower inflation and then move. And I think one could have defended that approach, particularly given how high inflation was going into this episode. But had we followed that approach, I think the loss of economic activity would have been greater, and the risk of an even bigger contraction would not have been addressed. Inflation might have ended up falling not only faster but further than we really needed to. So the board's view was that we ought to act to limit that downside risk to the extent that it was feasible to do so while remaining consistent with the target. Interestingly enough, the board had an advantage in reaching that decision from some earlier work which had been done. For the September 2007 meeting, a year earlier, the staff had prepared some outlook scenarios, which we occasionally do, and how could things be this way or that way from our central view. And one of those scenarios was one which contemplated what might happen if the global financial strains, which in September 07 were there but seemed to be being managed, what would happen if that all span out of control. And the conclusion that that work had reached was that in that world we would need to respond very quickly with an easing of monetary policy. So it took a year before the event contemplated in that hypothetical scenario actually happened, but when it did, we were a bit better prepared than we would have been otherwise. So that is the story of the conduct of policy in the crisis period, responding to risks of a very serious contraction with an aggressive easing. What about the conduct of policy in recovery? Along with the fiscal measures that the government took, the recovery in China, and assisted by the fact that Australia had a better starting point in a number of respects going into this episode than many other countries did, this approach has had some success in heading off the worst effects of a very serious international recession. Australia has had an experience that, even if we call it a recession, it was a pretty mild one. And clearly, in the circumstances, that's a good outcome. Now that the risks of a really serious economic contraction have passed, though, the question arises as to how to configure monetary policy for the recovery. And we've said several times now that over time, interest rates will need to be adjusted towards a more normal setting as the economy recovers. A step in that direction was taken, as you know, last week. And of course, there are still important matters of judgment in the timing and the pace of how that is done. There are still important areas of uncertainty in the global economy, and the board is very conscious of that. The board is also conscious, though, that a risk management approach, such as we've been pursuing, requires policy to be recalibrated as circumstances change. If we were prepared to cut rates very rapidly to a very low level in the face of a threat, but then we were too timid to start removing that stimulus when the threat had passed, well, we would end up with a bias, a serious bias in our policy framework. And bitter experience here and elsewhere counsels against that approach. None of this is to say that the economy as of today is too strong, quote unquote. It isn't. That's not the point. The point is rather that the very low interest rate settings that we had were designed for an economy which was weaker than the one we in fact are facing. Plainly, the downside risks to which the board responded quite properly have not materialised. That's not a problem. It's good, actually. It's very desirable. It's a welcome contrast to the situation that a number of other countries face. It simply means that we have to recognise that in the setting of policy, and that means not holding interest rates at a very low level when that isn't needed any longer. Well, let me conclude. The period of greatest weakness in the Australian economy is probably past. Barring another serious international setback, the economy is likely to continue on a path of gradual expansion in 2010. That being so, those of us involved in monetary policy must turn our thoughts to encouraging the sustainability of the expansion. That's particularly important for monetary policy given the lags that are involved in it having its effect. But in conducting policy during this expansion, our goals, our objectives, will be the same as they were in the previous one: to keep inflation low, to react in a measured but prompt fashion to changes in the risks facing the economy, and in so doing to play our part in fostering a long, sustainable period of growth. Our country faces many challenges in the future, but in my opinion, and I've said this all along, we can have confidence that we can meet those challenges. A sound monetary framework is one of the foundations for doing just that. Thank you very much for your attention.
Mr. Stevens, Graham Powell from ABC News in Perth. The interest rate rises in February and March last year were like a sledgehammer to the heads of consumers and home buyers. In hindsight, were they a mistake, and if not, why not? And you've raised rates already once this month. Is that because the economy is stronger than expected and you can see a return to, say, a cash rate of around 4% won't do much damage to the economy?
Well, a very neutrally asked question, Graham. No, the rate rises were not a mistake. They were necessary for the reasons I've just outlined. Inflation was too high. In fact, it turned out to be higher than most people, including us, knew at the time. So I don't have any reservations about those. Whether or not they were a sledgehammer could be a matter to be debated. The logic for last week's change, as I've said, both today and in the statement that we released at the time, was that the need for such an expansionary setting of policy, which on some occasions I've described as an emergency setting, has passed. And it's sensible and prudent to begin to remove it, and increasingly, I think, imprudent not to do so. The logic is that simple, as I think I've outlined here today.
Peter Kenyon, Curtin University. In your speech, Governor, you did point out that the target is based on, the inflation target is based on the CPI. Now, of course, many prices are not in the CPI, and in particular, asset prices such as housing, commodity prices and so forth are not part of the CPI. But quite often, these prices get out of sync with the CPI and cause all sorts of dilemmas to central bankers like yourself and raise the question of what to target. And, you know, there's the delightful phrase of one of your brothers in arms about irrational exuberance. Given the financial crisis that we've just, well, still experiencing, been through, could you respond to the idea that monetary policy might need to target other prices in ways in which asset prices are taken into account in some way? And secondly, do you see a role for variable capital controls over time, which reflect irrational exuberance, to be part of the armour of monetary policy? And thirdly, would you see such a an assessment of prices other than the CPI coming in the form of some sort of formal index or some sort of qualitative judgment about those prices.
So we're adding armour and sledgehammers. Pretty soon we'll have an axe, I guess. It's a very important set of questions you raised, and ones that I've actually been thinking about for a long time, and they're very difficult questions on asset prices. It's true, as you say, that asset prices per se are not in the consumer price index. There are 120,000 prices in that index, but housing values and so on are not. That's quite right. And the question of how to handle asset prices, and really I would rephrase it slightly as the asset price booms which are leveraged, because it's the leverage that's the problem. An asset boom and bust in a, if we have an asset boom and bust in old masters paintings, where the banks haven't lent the money, I'm not sure I'm that worried about that. It's where the financial system's lent the money for the asset price build-up that you have a problem, and it's really the leverage as much as the asset price itself, I think, that's the issue. I think the honest answer is that the central banking community is still struggling to know how to, you know, we don't want to throw away the inflation target system that's worked pretty well. It's actually worked very well in this country, and we haven't had a financial crisis, and we haven't had, to this point, a massive asset bust in this occasion that's brought down the banking system or done terrible damage. We've got to be careful that we don't, of course, in the future, but so far, you know, we have not encountered that problem, I don't think, in this episode. Nonetheless, the issue of how you keep the valuable part of the framework and how you, is there a way you can bring asset prices in? That's something people have not really come up with a very good answer to, apart from lengthening the horizon and saying, well, maybe we can target over a much longer period, and that allows us to take into account some of these asset price dynamics because they're quite long-run, low-frequency events. How feasible that really is to do, I think, is another question. Capital controls variable. Well, one of the ideas which is being worked on internationally is countercyclical capital buffers. That sounds good in theory. I'm not against it. However, I think that we should be realistic about how easy that will be to do when we have to do it in anger, because, you know, in a way we're doing countercyclical monetary policy, right? And it's conceptually not that hard, but the decisions are often pretty finely balanced and difficult ones to take, and it won't be any easier for the bank supervisors who will want to put up bank capital just at the time when the banks are feeling pretty good and will want to resist that. So I'm not against that idea. I think it needs a lot of development, though, as to practically how it will be done, and it won't necessarily be as easy as some people perhaps think. I think the third part of the question was, if we were to consider asset prices, is there a way of putting them all in one price index or not? I'm not sure there is. I think to the extent we should respond to those dynamics, it has to be judgmentally, really, and then we have to explain why we're doing it. And that's not an easy thing to do, which is why central banks are not across the world exactly at one on how that might be done. That's a long way of saying we're not sure what the answer to that question is as yet.
Mr. Stevens, Ben Wyatt, the Shadow Treasurer here in Western Australia, thank you for your presentation. Much has been made recently on the importance amongst the G20 countries in particular of coordinating monetary and fiscal policy. At the moment, monetary policy, whilst interest rates are still historically very low, are now starting to take a different direction from the federal government's fiscal policy. Can you provide us with some comments on the level of consideration that you think the Reserve Bank Board will place on the impact of the Commonwealth government's fiscal policy on the impact of interest rates in your meeting in November? And secondly, can you provide us just with some comments on your thoughts on the timing of the withdrawal of the federal government guarantee?
Well, I'm not going to foreshadow the nature of the discussion at the next meeting. That I don't think would be appropriate or wise. In the broad, the impact of the fiscal stimulus measures is something which is factored into the forecast that the staff make and which the board uses as a benchmark in its thinking. So the impact of all those measures, as best we can judge what they will be or are or what they have been, is in there. And then policy responds to the outlook for demand and prices. That's really all I can say about that question. On the guarantees, I have said before that to have the guarantees when we did was necessary, it was the right thing to do, but we don't want that extensive set of guarantees to be a permanent state of affairs. I think as soon as we are practically able to have private markets pricing private risk again, we should do that. Now, exactly when that is will be a matter of judgment, and it will be relevant what happens in other countries. And the Americans, I think, are on the brink of letting their guarantees lapse. Other countries are extending, so there's a mixed picture there, but Australia will have to take its decision in due course with an awareness of what's going on elsewhere and, of course, with an awareness of the readiness of the institutions here to cope without it. I think they will be ready to cope without it pretty soon, actually. But it's you know, there's a set of decisions to be made there. Someone's...
Yes. Mr. Stevens, Gary Jeffrey, in transition in the resource industry, other words, looking for a job. but you've presented a reasonably optimistic outlook, barring another international upset. In your scenario planning, where might such an upset come from? And secondly, closer to home, how large does the CPRS loom in your forward-looking assessments?
Where might another shock come from? I'm not sure there'll be one, actually. I don't think there'll be, but the point is simply that we don't know that for sure, and so we have to keep that possibility in mind. I guess, you know, and I don't want to hypothesise about it really in public, I don't think that's sensible, but we have to keep an eye on the real economies in some of the major countries who are struggling to recover from very deep recessions. I think they are recovering, but as always, in any cyclical turning point, there's a degree of tentativeness and uncertainty, and that's a bit greater now given the history of what's occurred. On the emissions issue, well, we've studiously avoided offering public commentary on this. It's not our business to do so. In due course, when the Parliament passes a package, there will be a set of estimates of its impact on the macro economy, and we will build that into our forecasts, and we will make a sensible assessment of whether they are material factors for monetary policy, and I don't think they will be, actually. But we'll set that out when the time comes in our documentation that we release publicly. But until the Parliament does pass something, I'm not proposing to offer any commentary on that beyond what we've given on other occasions.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens, David Airy, Real Estate Institute of Australia. There's been a lot of speculation about a housing price bubble, and I'm wondering what, if you can tell us to what extent the that will affect monetary policy and the bank's considerations as to how that would affect the cash rate.
Well, a lot of people have bandied the word bubble around. I'm not one of them, let me be clear, even though I'm often interpreted as having said that. I haven't said that. It is a fact, though, that housing prices have started to rise again. I think even in Perth that's probably beginning again. And they are high relative to history. That is part of the economic picture, the general economic picture that monetary policy looks at. What we try to do is build as complete a picture of what's going on as we can and then work out what that means for interest rates. That's not the same as saying that because housing prices are rising, that itself is going to drive a rate increase. We haven't said that. In fact, I've said that I wouldn't expect that per se to be the case. But the fact that housing values are increasing, I think, tells us some things about the economy, and that's important. But really, I think the issue of housing prices is not really a monetary policy question so much as, isn't it a social issue? Housing values are very high in this country. For a country with this much land, housing prices seem to me, personally, to be very high. The question is, isn't that a little surprising, and is it actually a good thing? I'm not sure it is. But that is not meant to be a comment about what we will do with interest rates about it. It's a more general observation.
A double barrel, if I may. First of all, the four banking pillars seem to becoming the nation's four pillars of wealth management. I'm just wondering if you've got any changes you're making to the system to take that transition into consideration. And secondly, are your back office beavers who work on the it won't happen scenario working on a $1.10 American?
I'm sorry, that question was, could we do a scenario with
The dollar with the speculators driving one Aussie dollar up to $1.10 American? Any tools in the toolbox there?
Well, since you ask a double barrel question, I always have the option of only answering one barrel. That's a trick I learned from a former treasurer, actually. Quite some treasurers back. I don't have any comments on four pillars. On the exchange rate, yeah, well, you could do a scenario where the exchange rate goes way up. I think the thing to be thinking about there is, why is it doing that? Just speculators perhaps could be a story, but usually there's a reason. And when you're thinking about what an exchange rate change up or down means, it's always important to have a sense of why it is that it's occurring. And I don't have any particular comments about the current level, but other than the observation that we've got one of the better performing economies in the world, even at very low interest rates, we still have a positive differential. And we're a country where the people here are, I think, reasonably confident about the future, and foreigners are fairly confident about our future, and it's not entirely surprising that they're a bit keen on the currency in those circumstances, given the state of some other countries. Of course, should it turn out that some of these other countries surprised by their strength over the coming year, that would be very interesting, because that could be make some considerable changes in some of these prices. But you could do a scenario of the one you suggest, and in that world, perhaps inflation's lower, but the reason the exchange rate would be up there is probably that there are some very strong growth dynamics and trade dynamics at work here, which was the reason it was rising. So you'd have to think all that through. You can't just do the exchange rates in isolation.
Thanks very much. Kurt McDonald from Australian Capital Equity. Thank you, Mr. Governor, for a very excellent presentation. You referenced, in terms of the cash rate setting, a variety of factors, and I want to come back to a couple that you mentioned, in particular the role of leverage. And the question really that I have to ask is, there's been a lot of speculation about the neutral cash rate setting and what that might look like. Mm. And without perhaps being too specific, could you comment on the role that one of the previous questions asked about asset markets the much higher use of leverage on an absolute level now in this economy generally, and whether or not that has altered the neutral rate setting in the bank's mind from previous episodes.
I'm not sure that it does alter it, or if it alters it, it's not clear in what direction it would be. I don't want to be specific about neutral per se, because I think we're far enough from it at the moment that we know it's higher than here, and that's the most important thing. Exactly what the number is, we could debate the number of angels on that pinhead, I guess, when we get closer. Does leverage change it? I'm not sure that the extent of leverage necessarily should change what the neutral rate is, but it probably has some bearing on how quickly we move the rate, because the impact, at least on certain parts of the economy, is leveraged by the higher debt burdens, which of course is one reason that the cuts were pretty powerful. So it's a reason for us to take a little care in implementation, which we always do, but as to whether it shifts the end point materially, that's a bigger, more complicated question that I don't think I can answer on my feet. Sorry.
Janice Dudley, politics at Murdoch University. Much of the commentary about Australia's effective and the way in which we've weathered the financial crisis has been put down to the level of prudential regulation in Australia. And there's been debate at the international level on coordinated international regulation of financial markets and financial products. And I wondered if you could comment on the mechanisms you see that are likely to be effective in developing international coordination of financial regulation, and secondly, the likelihood of that occurring.
Well, there has been for a long time, coordination is the wrong word, but consistency at least, in things like the bank supervision rules. You know, we have the Basel capital standards, which all advanced countries and many of the emerging countries basically sign up to. There's a bit of national discretion within those, but there's a fairly consistent set of arrangements there. So in that sense, the world has been moving in the direction of more consistency, which I think is actually the key thing, for quite a long time. As a result of the crisis, I think there will be some adjustments to those supervisory standards. And those adjustments are intended to address some of the things that we've been talking about in the discussion here. So the thrust of, and this work is being done at an international level through the Financial Stability Board, through the Basel Committee on Bank Supervision, through various other international bodies, all of which have been around a long time and which Australia plays some small role in. So that will be the mechanism. Those bodies really are the only effective mechanism we have for trying to get general consistency of regulatory frameworks. And the thrust of that looks like it's going to be particularly for large internationally active banks, more capital, higher quality capital, so more emphasis on common equity capital. For banks that do a lot of trading activity, which wouldn't include ours, but some of the big international ones, and that's where they first got into trouble, a lot more capital in that area. More focus on liquidity management, which I think has been shown that was a bit of a weakness, and so on and so forth. There are some other proposals being worked on there around what do we do about the problems of systemically large international institutions that operate across national borders and are very, very difficult to wind up if they fail, and very costly? That's actually a very, very hard question that the major players in the global economy are grappling with. So I think we will see some changes in the generally accepted regulatory standards. It's very important, by the way, that that is done in a careful fashion, and there's a lot of quantitative impact work that has to be done over the next year to make sure that the parameters that are chosen are the right ones. Otherwise, we could end up shooting ourselves in the foot if we implemented these changes in the wrong way. But that work has to be done, and it's going to get underway soon. So that's the general thrust and the coordinating device, to the extent there is one, these international bodies. I think on most international policy issues, you will never get perfect coordination. But if you have rough consistency of frameworks and a generally shared understanding of how the system works and what our goals are for it, that will do. That will do. And that will be good enough. If we strive for total perfection and total coordination, we'll be striving a long time and we won't get it.
Mr. Stevens, Gray Johnston, I'm an economics student at the University of Western Australia. I was interested in your response to the Shadow Treasurer's question about the bank guarantee. You seem to suggest that it should be turned on in bad times and then turned off again in good times. And this is the sort of implicit guarantee that we've seen governments all over the world introduce due to the crisis. Don't you agree that this introduces a moral hazard problem, and that it would be better for, in the long run, for all economies if governments made an explicit guarantee to not guarantee banking deposits, and so that businesses would be forced to price in risks accordingly?
Now, you raise a very important question. I do not think that we should have a system where at the first sign of trouble, the guarantee gets turned back on. We don't want to do that again. We want to make clear that this was a 1-in-75-year event. What was done had to be done, but it shouldn't be done again. It shouldn't be expected to be done again. And we want the financial system to not put governments in the position again where it would need to be done, which is why we have reforms to regulatory arrangements that we were just discussing with the previous question. Yes, there is a moral hazard problem. There always is if you take these sorts of steps to stabilise a system. And that is the dilemma that a policymaker on the day faces. He's got a long-run moral hazard problem that will get worse if he does something. If he doesn't do it, the problem won't be moral hazard, but it'll be a much bigger problem by this time tomorrow, possibly. So that's the dilemma that policymakers around the world found themselves in. And they had to do what was needed to stabilise things in the short term. But we do not want to go to a world where there's an optional guarantee that can... That is not what we want. What we want is to exit from this in a measured way and not have it happen again, and to spend the time between now and the next financial upset, and there'll be one someday. That's the nature of things. Spend the time between now and then making the system more robust so that the governments don't have to make that choice again. That's what we've got to do.